You're listening to a WebYeshiva.org podcast. Visit www.webyeshiva.org to take part in our fully interactive online yeshiva. Visit blog.webyeshiva.org for more free downloadable Torah content.
Hello, this is Ilana Goldstein-Sachs of Web Yeshiva with this week's Supporting Actor of the Week podcast. In Parashat B'Shalach, we read the story of the Battle of Amalek. And in that story, as is well known, Yehoshua is put in charge of, shall we say, the earthly battle down below, while Moshe goes up to the mountaintop to help fight the battle through more heavenly means. When he lifts up his hands, right as the story goes, B'nai Yisrael fight victoriously, but if he put his hands down, then the battle turned against them. And we're all familiar with the famous explanation in the Mishnah and in the Midrash that that this was not a magic trick of any sort, but rather Moshe's hands directed the soldiers' hearts toward Hashem, right upward toward Hashem, which in turn helped them win the battle. Anyway, we are told that Aharon and Hur go up the mountain with Moshe, and when Moshe's hands get heavy, when they get tired, they help him by supporting his hands. Now, this is the first time that Hur is mentioned in the Torah, with no introduction, no support, no attached genealogy to let us know who he is, right? This, of course, leads some to believe that he must have been a well-known personality who didn't need any introduction, which might very well have been the case. But it still does not help us, who are apparently less in the know. And Hur reappears in Parakaf Dalet of Shemot, when Moshe is about to ascend Har Sinai with Yehoshua to receive the Torah. Aharon and Hur, again, that pair is put together, are told to return to the camp with this kenim. And this kenim are told, Mi ba'al devarim yigash alehem. Anyone who needs judgment, right, need to settle some sort of situation between them, should go to them, to Aharon and Hur. Right? Meaning, Moshe is going to be out of town for a little while, so Aharon and Hur are kind of taking his place as judge while he is gone. Hur, or at least the name Hur, also appears in connection with the Mishkan, right, as the grandfather of Bezalel, the Mishkan's chief artist and artisan, Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur. And here we are told the additional information that he was from the tribe of Yehuda. According to our tradition, right, this is the same Hur. This seems logical, right? That this would be the same person, although apparently there are other opinions on this matter, but there's not much to go on either way, right? There's not much information for us to go on other than just, interpretation or assumption or tradition. These are the only mentions of Hur in the Torah, right? It is clear that Hur is not an insignificant person. He shows up in some pretty critical stories, and he seems to be part of the inner circle, right? He hangs out a lot with Aharon, as we've seen. And, of course, he's the grandfather, possibly, of this very important person who builds the Mishkan. But we are kind of left in the dark as to who exactly he is, like how exactly he fits into any sort of family tree or genealogy. The Midrash expands his role in the Torah slightly, giving us one more story about him. According to the Midrash, found in Masechet Sanhedrin, and Rashi quotes this Midrash, when the people are in the throes of Cheta Egel, the sin of the golden calf, Hur confronts them and is killed by them. Aharon, the Midrash says, sees what happened to Hur, and he realizes that confronting them will not work, and therefore he declares Chag LaHashem Machar, right, a holiday tomorrow, right, and there are many interpretations as to what exactly he was trying to do. Was he trying to delay any further worship of the Egel? One could interpret that, a different class, to discuss what was going on with Aharon there. And he builds a Mizbeach, Aharon builds a Mizbeach, And there's a big question as to what Aharon was trying to do there. This Midrash is linked to the text by a clever alternate reading of the words of the Pasuk. So let's read the Pasuk for a moment. We're talking about Shmot, Pasuk Lamed Bet, Perk Lamed Bet, Pasuk Hey. Vayar Aharon, Vayiven Mizbeach Lifanav, Vayikra Aharon, Vayomer Chag LaHashem Machar. Right, Aharon saw what was going on with Bnei Israel, that they had started worshipping the Egel. He builds a Mizbeach, And he calls out Chag LaHashem Machar, right? Will be a holiday for Hashem tomorrow. The Midrash says, Mara'a, it says Vayara Haron, Mara'a, Amar Rav Binyamin Bar Yafet, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Ra'a Chur Shizavuach Lefanav. Right? The pshat of the Pasuk would seem to be Vayara Haron means he saw what Bnei Israel were doing. Vayivan Mizbeach Lefanav, and then he proceeds to do what he does for whatever reason. But according to this Midrash, Aharon saw what he saw Chur, Shizavuach Lefanav. He saw that Chur had been slaughtered before him. And therefore he proceeds to do what he does. This Midrash is apparently based on a clever reading of the Pasuk, something akin to what we're familiar with the Al Tikre Midrashim, right? Like Al Tikre Banaich Ela Bonaich, right? Where a Midrashic idea is introduced by kind of changing the Nikud, the way of pronouncing a certain word in the Pasuk, which gives it a different meaning. So here, apparently, Vayara Aharon saw, Vayiven Mizbeach, instead of reading it as Vayivan Mizbeach, it's read as, this is how Rashi explains it, Vayivan Mizavuach Lefanav. He understood from the slaughtered before him. Right? And that is, of course, Chor in this Midrash. Reading, this clever reading of the Pasuk, of course, is only the excuse for the Midrash, so to speak. The real source comes from elsewhere. In part, right, it is likely an attempt to try to understand what Aharon was doing, reading when, you know, Aharon had already facilitated to some degree, again, this is a topic for a different class, the formation of the Egel. But here it might be an attempt to try to understand why did he go even further by building this Mizbeach. Was that a positive thing? Was that a negative thing? What was he trying to do? So it could be, this Midrash might be an attempt at trying to understand why Aharon did what he did. His apparently conciliatory approach to the Egel is better understood if the last guy to object, right, to try to stand up to Bnei Israel ended up, you know, dead. So that might be a way of trying to understand Aharon's behavior here. The other, perhaps even more significant goal of this Midrash is to answer another question, right? Where did Chur go? Right? We last saw him heading back to camp with Aharon and this Kenim, right? When Moshe and Yoshua are heading up Har Sinai, right? And we never hear from him again. Right, so in one fell swoop, this Midrash succeeds in not only closing this missing persons file, but in presenting, and this is also significant, the acting leaderships, meaning Aharon and Chur's response to the Egel as presented by Chur, meaning that Chur's response was what their real response was, right? And Aharon also, perhaps, would have agreed to this. But this Midrash enables us to understand what the official response was of this acting leadership, and also helps, as I already said, to explain, perhaps, at least in part, why Aharon seems to have diverged from this policy. The only other mention of Chur that we have, or I should say mentions, is in Divrei HaYamim, where Chur, right, the grandfather of Bezalel, is listed. And as we already know from Shmot, this is listed as part of the genealogy of the members of the tribe of Yehuda. The book of Divrei HaYamim adds for us that he is the son of a person named Kalev ben Chetzron, right? And Kalev's second wife, whose name was Ephrat. Right, meaning there was a man named Kalev ben Chetzron who was married to a woman named Ephrat. They had a son named Chur, who was the father of Uri, who was the father of Bezalel. These psukim, we also find out about the family there, show a very strong connection between this family and the land in the area of Hebron, which of course is in the portion of the tribe of Yehuda. And also, you know, in the area of Beit Lechem. And you know, this is where it begins to get interesting. According to the Midrash on these psukim in Divrei Yamim, Kalev ben Chetzron is the same as a more famous Kalev, right? Kalev ben Yifune, right, of Miraglim fame, right, who was also the Nasi of Shevet Yehuda. Kalev's wife Ephrat is none other, according to the Midrash, than Miriam, right, the sister of Moshe. As with all Midrashim of this sort, one always has to ask why. Right? Why does the Midrash claim that Hur is the son of Kalev ben Yefune and Miriam, when the Pasuk seems to say pretty clearly that he was the son of a different Kalev and a woman named Ephrat? And this could be answered on several levels. Let's start with the identification of Kalev ben Chetzron with Kalev ben Yefune. If one looks at the Psukim in Divrei Yamim, which mentions the two Kalevs, right, both Kalev ben Chetzron and Kalev ben Yefune are mentioned in different parts of the same section, they certainly seem to be talking about different people. Right? They have different fathers, they have different children. The only exception to this is Achsa. Right? In Sefer Divrei Yamim, it says that Kalev ben Chetzron had a daughter named Achsa. But we know that in Sefer Yehoshua, and also in Sefer Shoftim, we read a story where Kalev ben Yefune had a daughter named Achsa. Right, so this indicates to some that we are talking about the same person. Right, what's the likelihood that a man named Kalev, two men named Kalev, both have a daughter named Achsa? Whether that's convincing or not, decide for yourselves. Another possible contributor to this connection between the two Kalevs is that both Kalevs have a territorial connection to the area of Hebron. Right, so that's also interesting. As for the identification of Ephrat, as Miriam, the Midrash explains that Miriam was referred to as Ephrat, which is the name. You know, the name means something related to the word for fruitful in Hebrew, because she, Miriam, helped multiply Bnei Israel. This is probably a reference to the Midrashic idea that Miriam was Pu'ah, one of the two midwives who did not kill the Ivri boys at the beginning of Sefer Shemot. So another possible contributing factor to this Midrash, this connecting of Kalev to Miriam, that Kalev ben Yefune is married to Miriam, is the fact that we are never told that Miriam is married, right? Something that perhaps was not comfortable, it was a source of discomfort in the Midrash. As in other places, the Midrash kind of plays matchmaker and marries her off, in this case to Kalev. As for Hur, he's also given an identity, right? We saw before that we don't really know who he is exactly. He is the son of Miriam, which explains his status and his appearances with Moshe and Haron, right? We know where he is in this inner circle. We understand why he's always appearing right in the center of things. So in a double header of example of Midrashic, I'll call it law of conservation of biblical characters, Miriam and Hur and Kalev are neatly packaged together. It should be noted that in Divrei Yamim, it is explicitly stated, in case that wasn't clear before, that Bezalel is the grandson, or I should say Hur is the son of Kalev ben Chetzron, right? Not Kalev ben Yefune. He's not listed as the son of Kalev ben Yefune. So if the so this might be a way that we see in the Midrash that all of the Hurs, or both of the Hurs, are connected together, right? Because the stories about Hur, right, where he appears in the various stories in the Torah, those are the stories where he is referred to as the son of Miriam. So this connects to the Midrashim where Kalev ben Chetzron is Kalev ben Yefune and Ephrat is Miriam, right? Sort of kind of like links all of these various connections together in the Midrash. I'd like to suggest that there's more behind this Midrash, which identifies Hur as a child of Kalev and Miriam, than just these technical connections, right? Not that these connections aren't real, it might not be real motivations behind the midrashim, but I think there's more to it. And I think that it has to do with the characters, the personalities with which about which we are talking, which the Midrash here links up together. Kalev ben Yefune, for starters, exemplifies, personifies steadfastness, right? Particularly in the name of God. When the Meraglim are all doubting Hashem's ability to help them defeat their formative enemies, Kalev stands firm, right, and argues that they should not give in to their fear, because they will win if God is with them. Right? 40 years later, his steadfastness holds true. It is actually put to the test when, at the age of 85, right, he goes out and he conquers the giants of Hebron, right, thereby following through with actions what he said in words 40 years earlier. And for those of you who are interested, I once did a different podcast last year entitled Capturing Kalev, where I discussed this aspect of Kalev's personality more in detail. Right? Miriam shows very similar characteristics. This is most seen in the Midrashim and how they understand Miriam. The Midrash sees Miriam, like her Midrashic husband, Kalev, as determined and steadfast, particularly in the face of fear and difficulty. But according to the Midrash, it is Miriam who prophesies, and this is clearly based on the fact that the Torah calls her a prophetess, a Nevi'ah. She prophesies that Moshe is going to be the one to help redeem Bnei Yisrael from Egypt. And she, both in the Pshat and in the Midrash, does everything that she can to make sure that this will happen. And she's the one who watches out for Moshe when he's put into the Teva on the Nile by his mother. Right? She's the one who's determined to make sure that he gets where he needs to go and that he'll be provided for as necessary. It is she, according to the Midrash, but again, based on these qualities that we see in the story, the Pshat, she's the one who insists that Am Yisrael must remain strong in their faith, in Hashem, and also in the faith that he will redeem them, right? And therefore, for example, her parents must not refrain from having another child out of fear that if it is a boy, he will be killed, right? It's no wonder that according to the Midrash, she is one of the midwives who fought for the lives of the Israelite babies. When Paro declared that they should all be killed, right? And she is called a Yiret Elokim, right? She fears God, but she fears just about nothing else, right? So she is the one who keeps the nation strong. She is the one who, appropriately, who, after all the miracles have happened, leads the women in song in recognition of everything that Hashem has done for them, right? So Kalev and Miriam represent the strength that comes from believing in the strength of God, right? And particularly that it is important not to fear the future, right? They shouldn't be afraid if they understand that Hashem is with them. And as part of this, right, this aspect of Kalev and Miriam's personalities, they find themselves often in the supporting role of Moshe, right? Kalev, by essentially fighting Moshe's battle against the Meraglim, and Miriam by fighting for Moshe's very life early on. When looking for a familial link between Hur and the nation's leading family, he must have been part of that family one way or another, right, as we saw, you know, his importance and his constant placing within that inner circle. So nothing seemed more natural than giving him to Miriam and Kalev, right? He, like them, supported Moshe, literally and figuratively, right, by holding up his hands in battle and by taking his place on the judge's bench in Moshe's absence. But also, according to the Midrash, and don't forget that when Midrashim are created, right, they often take into account previous Midrashim, although it's often hard to know which Midrash preceded which. One might assume that in this case, the broader understanding of Hur's personality, which included the story of him dying fighting against the Egel, right, might have already been in mind when these other midrashim came about. In that midrash, he's fighting Moshe's battle when Moshe himself was not able to do so. Right? Moshe's up on the mountain, and he's basically fighting Moshe's battle by fighting against the Egel Hazahav. So that, right, and that the son of Miriam and Kalev could die trying to convince the nation not to give in to their fears, right? Not to worry so much because Moshe had not come back yet, and that they have to have faith. Right? This is quite believable, right? It's believable that Miriam and Kalev could have a son who would also try to teach the people to hold stand strong and not fear, and instead should hold strong in their faith. As I said, it's not always possible with Midrash to know which traditions preceded which Midrashic ideas came first and are assumed by the others which came later. But one can speculate, right? And that's kind of where the fun comes in with Midrash. And here we seem to have a good example of Midrashim, about biblical personalities, which are based on the qualities expressed in the biblical stories themselves, and which expand the characters in keeping with their biblical personalities. And once this Midrashic expansion has taken place, the ideas expressed therein are assumed by those who came later, and they make further links and associations between the biblical personalities discussed in the Midrashim, such as those we studied today. And this, of course, helps further enhance our understanding and appreciation of those biblical personalities. Right? We see this in many places in the Midrash, and I think we see it here in the example of Hur and his Midrashic parents as particularly well, right? A particularly strong example.